So let's take a moment to bring our minds to rest from our day so far. Maybe let your attention descend into your body, what it feels like to be in your body in this present moment of awareness in this environment. All senses open, watching thoughts come and go, not jumping on the train or getting off whatever train we're on, so that we can attend to the words of our prayers. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru, four continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. The four dharmas of Gampopa, Dharam Sinshan Tam Chelo Chusu Drawers and Jilab Tu Sol, Chalam De Drawers and Jilab Tu Sol, Am Chulpa Sellers and Jilab Tu Sol, Chulpa Yeshe Suchavers and Jilab Tu Sol. I pray for blessing, may my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing, may the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing, may the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing, may confusion arise as wisdom. And from the aspiration to excellent conduct. Lai ke dang lu dang nu jin ke chulum darami ke nam dang roa kunji daki jitsam par tam chi ke di daki cha ten to. In the tongues of nagas, yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And the reminder for arousing bodhicitta. Same words Lama Nar Rinpoche used to recite at the beginning of teachings. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. And so right away, we will go into the meditation part of that resolution. So today we're going to do the two wings of awakening, basically, but we're going to give a little extra emphasis to the four thoughts because we have completed them now almost. We're still working on karma, but the first few chapters of Ornament of Precious Liberation introduce the four thoughts at some length. So we now have a lot of material fresh in our minds, a lot of contemplation material fresh in our minds for each of the four thoughts. So as we begin the meditation and we get to the four thoughts, which I'm going to read from my translation of the Nundro by the Ninth Karmapa, we can just take a couple of minutes for each one just to bring to mind what we know about it and then rest. You know, you can use some words to bring to mind what you know about that particular thought or reminder, or you can just rest in the words that are spoken. So we'll do a little bit of a more leisurely contemplation on the four thoughts and then do the rest of the two wings. So first, once again, just letting ourselves open up into open awareness, or follow the breath as an introduction if that's easier, just to bring our minds to rest a little bit. And now the four reminders. First, the precious human existence, which is the second prerequisite for traveling the path. No human, precious human existence, no path. So in the words of the ninth Karmapa Dorje from the Kagyu Preliminary Practices, first I must meditate on this precious human existence with its freedoms and resources, difficult to attain, easily destroyed. From now on, I must make it meaningful. We could remember the freedoms and resources. We could remember the reasons that it's difficult to attain a precious human existence, how very fortunate we are to have one in this lifetime. We could think of all the ways that it can be destroyed so easily. And we could think about the need to not waste it while we have it. So just resting in that appreciation. And secondly, everything is impermanent, the world and all it contains. So as we go through this one, we can remember all the points from the chapter on impermanence, which is the antidote. Like through really doing this contemplation, we can free ourselves from the first obstacle to awakening, which is being overly attached to the activities of this life. We remember everything is impermanent, the world and all that it contains. In particular, the life of beings is as fragile as a bubble of water. Water. The time of death is uncertain. And when I die, I will be nothing but a corpse. At that time, only the Dharma can help me. I must practice diligently. Third, karmic cause and result. And so karma and what's wrong with samsara, or the suffering of samsara, are the two antidotes to the second obstacle to awakening, which is when we're not too busy being too easily led astray by the pleasures of, by the worldly pleasures of samsara and whatever distractions we may have in our lives. Here they're reversed from the ornament of precious liberation. So first, karma. Thirdly, at the time of death, I will not be free. My fate will depend upon my previous actions. I must therefore refrain from negative actions, always engage in positive actions, and each day monitor my stream of being. So through contemplating this reminder about karma, it may help us the next time we're about to be distracted and lose our practice time, might remind us why we want to make sure we have time to practice. We could contemplate what kind of distractions normally derail us. We could contemplate what kind of actions we normally habitually engage in and where those might lead us based on what we've learned from Gampopa. And we might ask ourselves, as we contemplate those distractions, the question that Pema Chodron says that she asks herself, is this what I want to reinforce? What is it that I do want to reinforce? What is it that I want to take with me into my next lifetime or into the next moment of my existence? Into the next time I'm tempted to engage in a negative action. And then the last one, fourthly, all places, friends, pleasures, possessions, and everything else in the cycle of existence continually torment me through the three types of suffering. The suffering of actual pain, the suffering of pleasure, which turns into pain, and the suffering of conditioned existence, which is disintegrating moment by moment. They, meaning all places, friends, pleasures, possessions, and everything else, they are like the last meal before my execution. We could think of that last meal. We could have the most wonderful meal in the world, like our very favorite foods. But if we're going to die, like a few minutes after, like what's really the meaning of that pleasure? I must sever all attachment and diligently accomplish awakening. And that is the resolve that ends the four thoughts. I must sever all attachment, everything that keeps me from waking up, and diligently accomplish awakening. So next we invite the Lama's blessing, visualizing the Lama or the Buddha above the crown of our head on a lotus and moon seat in a body of light, radiating love, compassion, and awakening. With or without words, requesting the blessing of the Lama or the Buddha that we may follow the path and we may attain the same qualities that we see in them. In a really heartfelt way, which is what actually triggers the blessings. And just by asking in this heartfelt way, just by opening our heart in this way, we receive the blessings of the Lama or the Buddha. And then we can visualize them descending into our heart center and resting there. So from our heart center now, through the Lama, through the Buddha that is part of our innate nature, we radiate love, compassion, and awakening to everyone. And now here in the 7 points of mind training, this is where we begin a short period of calm abiding meditation. So again, you can bring your attention back to following your breath, or to a particular sensory object, or just to open awareness, resting in awareness with all senses equally open. Just resting for a moment. And now we'll just quickly touch on all the steps of cultivating ultimate bodhicitta. First, we look at all experience as a dream, everything we're experiencing in this moment right now, in this present moment of awareness, is no different from what we experienced in our dream last night. And then turning our attention inward to examine the nature of awareness, which is unborn, looking at the mind itself. Asking a question, if that's helpful, and just resting in that looking. Just getting in touch with our mind as opposed to our sensory perceptions. And then once we're in touch, we let even the remedy release naturally. So now there's no further work to do. We simply let our minds be at rest, in touch with this looking at our mind, and we rest in the essence, the basis of everything, which is basically just like Shine, but with our attention directed inward towards our own nature. And without losing touch with this, resting in our own nature, we practice taking and sending, alternately synchronizing with the breath, and just choose whatever object you wish for your taking and sending today. We'll just do a couple of minutes. Could be yourself, could be someone you know, could be some group of people, could be the earth itself. Or beings in any of the six realms. Lama Norla Rinpoche taught that one way to combine relative and ultimate bodhicitta in this meditation is that when we breathe in the suffering and we breathe out the happiness or the peace, whatever we're breathing out in between the in-breath and the out-breath, there can be a little pause. And in that pause, we can look at who it is who's doing, who's breathing in the suffering, who's breathing out the happiness. Or we can remember that it's just like a dream. And now, whoever we've been doing taking and sending for, let's open that up into all sentient beings, all the six realms, every kind of suffering that there is. We're breathing it all in from every single sentient being, into our vast Buddha nature, and breathing out whatever is needed, breathing out happiness, peace, healing, breathing out awakening. And thinking that through this practice, ourselves and all sentient beings are completely awakened, completely freed from suffering, completely filled with well-being. Rejoicing in that. Letting go of all visualization and conceptualization. Resting in open awareness or following the breath. And now coming back to study karma. Okay, well, we covered the first half. Does anybody have anything before we get started on karma, part two? Okay. Oh, John, I just want to show you that the microphone and my earbuds is right here, built into the earbuds. All right, so let's see. We did that. Okay, so in karma, I'm going to take a look very briefly at Ornament of Precious Liberation on page, the beginning of the karma chapter, which is page 77. We're just going to quickly review point one and point two that we covered last week. So he begins by telling us that everything that we experience comes from karma. Our world is created by karma. And he has various quotes from the Buddhist literature to support that. And then on page 78, middle of the page, actions and their consequences are summed up through 6 points, same way he introduces every topic: categories, characteristics, ownership, apportionment, inflation, and ineluctability. We will learn what those last four categories are today. But last week we went over the first 2 points. So first are its categories. This is the paragraph right below that list. Non-virtuous actions and their effects. That is what we covered in detail last week. Second category is virtuous actions and their effects. Much shorter because it's basically the opposite of the non-virtuous actions. And then third, the action of unwavering karma and its effect, which we're going to look at in Luminous Mind, Kala Rinpoche's Luminous Mind, very briefly, but just so we understand what that's referring to. It's much clearer in Kala Rinpoche than it is in Ornament of Precious Liberation. And then, so last week we went through all of the non-virtuous actions, the 10 non-virtuous actions. I think actually at this point, we went through the 10 non-virtuous actions, and each of them had not only an explanation of like the three categories of each unvirtuous action, but also a worst case for each unvirtuous action. Good to know what those are. We definitely want to avoid those. Some of which are, you know, included in the 5 actions of immediate consequence, the worst possible things we can do in this life. And then he also intriguingly gave us some information about how the karma of each particular negative action can manifest in the future. So one thing that he didn't address, we're going to get some more of that today. We're actually not going to read it directly because it would take too much time away from other points. But I'm just going to summarize. So Gampopa next gives us several other factors that can influence how the karmic result of our actions manifest. But first we're going to look on page 47 of Ringu Tulku, the 4 ways karma matters, because it's another piece of information, you know, in the complexity of how karma works, how our karma can manifest as a result of our actions. So page 47, the 4 ways karma matures. Although this is not mentioned in Gampopa's text, he covers like everything else, but he doesn't cover this one. It is useful to specify the 4 ways that karma matures. And this has to do with when we get the result. So the first way that karma can mature is immediate. What we call instant karma, I think. We can have instant karma where the action is immediately followed by its result. We hit someone and they hit us back. That's instant karma. You know, you did the deed and you paid it off right away. We insult someone and he replies straight away. This boomerang effect happening during one life, like within the same lifetime or even within the same 5 minutes, is called the immediate result. So that's one way you can pay it off right away if the circumstances are conducive to that. That's probably the best, considering other things we're going to learn about karma, that category called inflation. The second way, if it isn't paid off immediately, the second way is when the result is not immediately visible in this life, but occurs in the next life. So karma can wait. Like, it doesn't have the conditions. You did something, you lied, you stole, you killed somebody, but the conditions are not right in this lifetime for that to be paid back. It's going to be paid with interest. That's what inflation means. So it's actually better if it's paid off right away, but it could be paid off in the next life or any future lifetime, really. I think we're going to get to that. The third way is when the result is produced in an unspecified future, as the act committed was not very strong. The fourth way is when it is not clear whether the action will even have a result or not. It is so weak, it may not have any significant consequence. The four ways that karma ripens depend on the strength and motivation behind the action. The stronger the emotion, the motivation and the aspiration are, the more noticeable the result. So you don't have to remember all this. I mean, that's kind of like the point, is don't try to remember all of this. We're just, what we're getting here is just a flavor of how complex karma is. And so you can't really look at somebody, something bad happens to somebody, including yourself, you can't trace back where it came from. It's really not a fruitful, you know, line of inquiry, because it's too complicated. So to finish what Ringu Tulku has to say here, the importance of the strength of our motivation shows that our future is not totally determined by our past action. So he's going to make a really interesting and helpful point here. Suppose that due to the karma associated with our past actions, we are supposed to act in a certain way. So we did something in the past and it created the conditions or the karmic result or habituation that would make us act a certain way in the future. But if our present motivation somehow goes in the opposite direction and is very strong, say we're a Dharma practitioner and we've learned that that kind of action is just digging us deeper into samsara and causing ourselves suffering and harming others into the bargain, maybe we've seen that since we committed that action. So if our present motivation goes in the opposite direction and is very strong, strong enough to outweigh the karmic result, then the consequence of our negative karma can be postponed or even avoided, and we can then take a new direction. When the stronger motivation overpowers the weaker, it is an example of what we call the immediate result. Naturally, these mechanisms also apply to positive actions. So if you did something really good in the past, in your past lifetime or last week, and you're expecting a really good karmic result, but in the meantime, you develop a grudge against somebody or, you know, whatever it is that you do, you could also cut off a good karmic result. So that's just a little aside. I'm going to unmute you, Imogen, so I have to move my notes. Can you? Yes, Lama Jinzang.
I'm a little confused just because it says the very first thing is immediate result.
Which I'm not. I understand what you're going to ask, and I can't. I don't know why it's both called the same thing.
Okay, never mind.
It's not going to help us to try to figure that out. But please contemplate that, anybody, in your spare time.
mute me.
No, I totally was like, I was noticing that too, and I hadn't noticed it when I read it before. I'm like, uh-oh, now we're in trouble. He's calling this the immediate result, and we don't know how that corresponds. But we don't. At least I don't. Anybody else have something? Anything? Yes, Kathy, I'm unmuting you.
Hi.
We're on page 49, except we're about
That's the question.
We're about to go into the other book. We're about to actually go into me summarizing the other book. But okay. That's where we are, page 49. We're going to come back to page 49.
Thank you.
Whatever the next page is. We will pick up again on page 48, Breaking the Chain of Karma, a little bit later in the class.
Okay.
Okay. And welcome.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Any page numbers? Any insights? All right. So what we're going to do now is I'm looking at page 80. Page 82. of Ornament of Precious Liberation. And I, again, I just haven't looked up the page numbers in the other translations, so you'll have to find it. But it's right after the negative actions, the section right after the negative actions. And it begins in this translation, the above was a general explanation of the ripened results of negative actions. Three kinds of ripened results of an action can be distinguished according to the affliction present, the frequency of the action, or the person acted on. And I'm not going to read this. It's very interesting, but I'm going to hopefully save a little time. I want to just look at what the structure of the information we're getting here, how it all fits together. And it includes those categories. So what we have, Torch of Certainty told us that karma, and Ringo Tuchel also told us that karma is too complex for us to really understand how it works until we get to the realization of equal taste, which is one of the Mahamudra level, Mahamudra levels, Mahamudra realization levels. So in the meantime, the only thing we really need to keep our eye on is, like, if we do negative actions, we are going to create suffering. And if we do positive actions, we are going to create happiness. That's all we need to remember. But in the meantime, Gampopa and Ringo Tulku have given us a fair amount of information here just to give us an idea, like a taste of it. So what we have is, first of all, the list of unvirtuous actions, that the nature of the action is negative. I mean, this is the main point. This is verse 8 in the 37 practices. Like, the first level of motivation to practice the Dharma is to avoid suffering. And the way to avoid suffering is to avoid harmful actions. Harmful actions, all the harmful actions, you may have noticed when we were studying it last week, they all lead to the lower realms. They don't lead to the upper realms. They only lead to either the hell realms, the hungry ghost realm, or the animal realm. So first thing when we're understanding how to organize our actions is to avoid negative actions, period. But then we have several layers of information. Gampopa first gave us the different ways that the result of each action can manifest. And that there's three different possibilities that he listed. One, there can be a direct or ripened result, which is, it sends us to a particular realm in our next lifetime. Each action has a corresponding realm that it, it gives you the propensity to be born in. Second is what's called the corresponding or similar result. So karma can also manifest if you're born human in the next lifetime. You dodge the lower realms, thank God, but you're human and you've got that karma to pay off. So, like, if you, so you get like a human life in which your experience is similar to the negative action that you created. For example, if you killed somebody, you get killed in your next life as a human. You miss the hell realms. It wasn't that bad, but you get killed, or you just have a short life from illness or whatever. or if you engage in divisive speech habitually, then you don't have any friends in your next lifetime. so that's first the direct result, where you get reborn. Second, the corresponding result, what your experience is like in the human realm. And then third, the environmental or dominant result, which is being reborn into a particular type of unpleasant environment. So that's one way that negative action, the result of negative actions, can manifest. But so what he gives us next on page 82 is three more things that can influence how the karmic result manifests. And so the first one is, it's actually influenced by our motivation. So what, even if our negative action is a lie or idle speech, I guess idle speech wouldn't count here, a lie, or, you know, let's just say, you know, a lie. If we lie because of anger, that tweaks our karmic result towards the hell realms, because anger sends you to the hell realms. If we lie through attachment because we want something, that tweaks it towards the hungry ghost realm. And if we lie out of confusion or ignorance, then that tweaks it towards the animal realms, no matter which action it is. So motivation is one influence. Next influence is how often we do it. If we do the same negative action a lot of times, whichever action it is, that's more hell realm karma. If we do it sort of a more moderate amount of times, number of times, that's more hungry ghost level karma. And if we don't do it a lot, that's more, we might escape like the worst results and get into the animal realm instead. Are you with me so far? Is this making sense? Okay. And then the other thing, so it's influenced by motivation, it's influenced by how often we did it, and then the third is that it's influenced by who we do it to. Who is the victim of our negative action? If it's a very special person, you know, if we assassinate the Archduke Ferdinand, like that, that's bad. That's taking us towards the hell realms because it was a really important person. We started World War I. If it's a person of more moderate importance, then that's hungry ghost realm level because that's, you know, it's not as bad a realm. And then if it's a less, if it's a nobody, we just killed a nobody or we lied to somebody who really doesn't matter, then we get off in the animal realm. I find this fascinating, although I am not going to break my head on it because of all the warnings that, you know, don't go there. Just remember good equals happiness, bad equals suffering. Yes, I'm going to unmute you, Marilyn. Yes.
This, the person of the nobody issue brings up the fact that anybody might be a bodhisattva. So yeah.
That's true. We don't know how important that person is that we might be killing or lying to or stealing from. Very good point, Marilyn, thank you. Or as what Carbo Mongmo put it, right, in one of her little aphorisms, she said, anybody on the street could be more enlightened than me. That was one of my favorite lines in her book. She Ate Snow was the book. All right, so, and then we have now, Ringu Tulku's addition into the mix, like, which is just when the karma can manifest, which is a slightly different category, not so much how, but when and with what strength it will manifest. So it's all very interesting. We're going to leave it there. I certainly can't analyze it any further, but I just think it's really interesting. So I think one of the reasons that we're given this information is it's very tempting once you know a little bit about karma. Probably we would not fall into that because we've all been around the Dharma a long time. But somebody first learning about karma, and I've seen this, and I probably did it myself. It's like you try to figure it out. Like, okay, what did I do? I have this problem in this life. What did I do in my last life? So karma is not actually about that. I'll get you just a second, Dave. Karma is not about figuring out what got us here. It's about figuring out how to get where we want to go. Like, let's keep our eye on that ball. How do we clean up our act so that we move towards awakening? We never end up in the lower realms. We move towards like well-being and towards awakening. yes, Dan, sorry, Dave, you're unmuted.
I was just going to say, for me, liking complexity and causality and stuff, I used to get into that a lot. What's the karma, this and that. Yeah. I think that's an excellent issue for just more attachment. Yeah. You get really attached to, oh, what is the karma of my thing? You know, now that I'm knowing it's karma, what is it? What, you know, and it's just like another attachment.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what we're encouraged to avoid, even though we've now been armed with this valuable information. Thank you, Dave. And I just want to say, it is sometimes useful. There's one way we can use, like, looking back at past karma, like what we might have done in the past, that is actually very constructive. And I learned this from Lama Dachen, and I know I've said it before. I was in 3-year retreat with Lama Dachen. And, you know, in 3-year retreat, lots of things can happen. There's always things like, you know, interpersonal things, because you're stuck in this small space with people all the time, and there's, you know, you're hurrying from this to that. But anytime she would feel disrespected by someone in some way, her first impulse was to say, I must have done that to somebody in the past. And it just sort of takes the blame out of it. It just takes the person, it's not personal anymore. It's like, okay, I just paid off a karma. And if you can think like that, that is the constructive way to to use the past and think, how did I end up in this? How did I end up with this person yelling at me? Oh, I must have yelled at somebody this way in a past lifetime. It's actually really helpful, and it helps strengthen your resolve not to do that anymore, because suddenly you know exactly what it feels like to have that thing done to you that you sort of habitually do to other people. The worst thing we experience in life is somebody doing to us what we do habitually and aren't really aware of. And often we don't even notice that that's what's happening. I know this from examining my own experience and perhaps that of my family. So anyway, so karma is complicated, and you could study this a lot. I think it's really helpful. But we're going to move on to virtuous actions, and we're going to look at them in Ornament of Precious Liberation. In this version, it's page 82. Virtuous actions and their effects. We're going to actually read this section because it's actually really helpful. I mean, often we just say, oh, well, it's just the opposite of the non-virtuous actions. And that's, I don't really go into the details myself that often, but he actually lists them here and it's helpful. So page 82, bottom of the page, virtuous actions and their effects. First, we consider the actions. The 10 virtuous actions consist of renouncing the non-virtuous ones. And furthermore, not enough just to not kill. It becomes a virtuous action when you engage in the opposite, in its counterpart, the things that should be done. Protecting the lives of others, giving lavishly, counteract stealing, maintaining a pure sexual conduct, as we discussed last week, just don't do anything that's going to hurt another person. Speaking the truth straightforwardly, dispelling discord among people and bringing them into harmony. Speaking peacefully and sincerely in a way that pleases others, that's the counterpart of harsh speech. So make a point of speaking peacefully. Make a point of speaking in a way that's pleasant for people to hear, even if you're delivering the criticism that they need to hear or whatever. Speaking in a way that is meaningful, reducing desire. And so now, so those are the three of body and the four of speech. And now we're into the three mental ones. So to counteract malevolence or ill will, this is covetousness, pardon me. Reducing desires and being content with what one has. And as we learned last week, also just not being too invested in what you have. Like, don't be too proud of what you have, and also don't covet what other people have, but be content with what you have. Counteracting malevolence or ill will, cultivating loving kindness and the like. And then the third one, counteracting wrong view, which is not believing in karma and so forth. Penetrating the highest meaning, study, contemplation, and meditation counteracts wrong view. So that's the actions themselves. So before he talked about like the consequences, like how each of the negative actions could manifest as a result. So he says these virtuous actions have threefold consequences as well. The ripened result is rebirth in the human or divine planes of the desire realm, meaning the three higher realms, human, not gods, and gods. The corresponding or similar result will be, for instance, if you're born in a human life, that by abandoning harm to others and by protecting life, you yourself have a long life. Longevity is gained. And similar for the other virtues. The dominant or environmental result is that by giving up killing, you will be reborn in a very prosperous and powerful place, and so on and so forth, you know, with some corresponding good environment for each positive action. Okay, so the above was an explanation of beneficial actions and their consequences. So now we have the non-virtuous actions, we have the virtuous actions, and what's left is the action of unwavering karma and its effect, which is on page 83, and we're not going to read that. It's actually quite long and detailed. And if anybody wishes to read that, I mean, I did read through it, but I didn't feel like I really needed to know that for practical purposes right now in my life. But I did feel that what Kala Rinpoche had to say about it in Luminous Mind was really helpful. And this is the chapter called The Karma of Meditation. I don't know if it helps you to see that, but it's chapter 5 and page 121 if you happen to have Luminous Mind in front of you, or make a note and you can look it up. So we're just going to read a little bit of this because he also goes into some detail about each of the realms we're talking about. So he says, again, this is Kala Rinpoche, who often comes to the rescue on difficult topics. The karma of this third main category, non-virtuous, virtuous, and then we have unwavering, or he calls it the karma of meditation, or his translator does, is called unmoving karma. So it's called unwavering, it's called unmoving, it's called the karma of stillness by Ken MacLeod in Kala Rinpoche's writings in that book. So there's something about it that's not moving. It proceeds from first having abandoned negative actions and practiced positive ones, which should have become habits. The causes of unmoving karma are different. So you've already given up negative actions. Like, this is for somebody, you don't even have to worry about this kind of karma if you're still working on refraining from the 10 unvirtuous actions. So I think I certainly am still working on that category myself. So, comes from first having abandoned negative actions and practiced positive ones. So somebody's got all that stuff together. You've got that stuff together, your conduct in this lifetime and your daily activities. You're not hurting anybody and you're going out of your way to help. And it's become habitual. So how do you get the result of unwavering karma? The causes of unmoving karma are different practices of mental stabilization, or dhyana in Sanskrit. That's like meditative states. And specifically, these refer to states of calm abiding, shine meditation. There are levels of shine meditation where you're just resting your mind in what can become bliss if you get really good at it and you've given up negative actions and do good things, then your happiness result could be these states of blissful, peaceful absorption, meditative absorption. So their results are rebirths in states of absorption corresponding to those of the mind. These meditation levels or mental absorptions make up the divine realms in the subtle form and formless realms. Now, harking back to the 37 practices, in verse 29, on the Paramita of meditation, we are cautioned to avoid the four form and formless realms. Like, we don't want to get stuck there. That's a place you can get stuck. It's still in samsara. And I'm going to just read Kala Rinpoche now because he's going to say that later. So the cause, it was the last paragraph we'll read here. The cause of the karma of immobility. Now it's the karma of immobility. So imagine, like, you're in this perfect state of shine. You're not moving, right? Like, your body is still and your mind is still, because shine meditation is about finding the stillness that normally is hidden to us. So the cause of the karma of immobility, then, I'm not sure I like that one. That sounds really unpleasant, actually, is a virtuous mind abiding in absorption on a single object. One-pointed meditation on a single object. Its causes and results develop in 8 stages, each of which has a preliminary, a practice, and a resulting state. We are not going to read about that. We're going to skip to the end of this chapter, which is on the next page, page 122. He says, so this is the zinger. This is why Tokme Zangpo said, don't go there. Like, this is not where you want to go. He said, although these 8 absorptions are lofty meditative states, they are like the pinnacle of shine meditation. They're very, very pleasant, is my understanding. Although these 8 absorptions are lofty meditative states, they still occur within samsara and therefore are conditioned by its illusions and subject to transmigration. So you're still stuck in samsara, and technically these are the gods' realms. Like, there's the desire gods realm, which is the one we think of as like movie stars and rich people, you know, Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and, you know, Oprah Winfrey. They're all up there, and all the movie stars, and they can get whatever food they want, and they have servants to do everything. Their life is just bliss, bliss, bliss. But what's the suffering of that? Like, Pema Chodron said a wonderful thing that has so stuck with me. In her teaching at Omega last year, you know, we went over it, the 6th realm. She said, in the human realm, pleasure and pain alternate. And we're always trying, our phrase is, if only I could do this, or if only I had this, then my life would be perfect. We're always looking to get rid of the suffering component and just have pleasure. But she said, that's actually aspiring to the God's realm, because that's what the God's realm is. And she said, it's not a good place to be. You don't want your life to be all pleasure, because the suffering of the God's realm is that it's impermanence. It's impermanent, and you're going to fall from it. Even from the formless realms, you fall. And you fall into the hell realms, it is said, because you've exhausted all of your good karma, you know, enjoying that life. So we don't want to end up there. And an unwavering karma is not what we want to pursue, although meditation is a tool that we need. And shine, developing shine and one-pointedness are tools that we need. We always have to keep moving. We don't want to get immobilized. The last paragraph here, everything that exists within samsara is brought about by the three types of karma, review of Gampopa's first category, negative, positive, and unmoving. All three are said to be contaminated because they imply a distinction between a subject, an object, and an action. And they condition all dualistic experiences. So we're still stuck in, samsara is being stuck in dualistic perception, right? That is basic ignorance. That's the cause of all of it. And from that ignorance arise all of the negative emotions that get us into trouble. So, but even if we overcome the negative emotions, you know, we don't engage in negative actions of any kind. We only do good things. And we practice, we could get stuck in like the highest pinnacle of samsara. So that's the third category. Does anybody have any questions? I don't have any further information on those, but yes, first Joanne and then Anne. Okay, Joanne.
Mama, I'm kind of back on verse 29. But mm-hmm. that particular verse and the form and formless realm, it's come up in my my studies. Mm-hmm. And now is my opportunity to ask you to clarify.
Okay.
What aspect of those are to be avoided? That's where I'm a little uncertain. What are they?
Okay, let's look at that. We're going to take a quick look at verse 29. Yes, I always keep these handy. Okay, to vanquish my emotionality, I need insight based in tranquility. So this is the paramita of meditation. We're like getting a preview way down the road of the path. I need insight based in tranquility. So that's it right there. That's the answer right there. I'll come back to it. I'll read the rest of the verse. To understand this and to cultivate a stable, focused meditative state, not getting stuck in the four formless realms, this is the way a bodhisattva trains.
Okay, what are the four formless realms?
We're not going into detail on those. That's what we just described.
Okay.
Those are the states where, like, you even transcend, it sounds like a physical body, but honestly, I really don't know more about them.
Okay.
There's the desire realm of the gods, which is where you still have the body. And then there's the sort of subtle form realm, and I don't really know what this means. And then there's what's called the formless realms.
All right.
And those are just high meditative states. That's okay. What they are.
Thank you, Lama.
Okay. But here, so this is the answer though, like how do we avoid them? I need insight based in tranquility. So tranquility is calm abiding meditation. And we need that. We need that. That's what we need. But we also need insight, which is the next level of meditation, which is just to look at the nature of mind through what's called vipassana or laktong or insight meditation. So you have to use your shine skill. You develop that skill to rest one-pointedly. Oh, sorry, let me just get rid of the screen share. You need that skill of resting one-pointedly, but you don't stop there. And like you think that's it, that's meditation, I'm going to spend the rest of my life like this. You have to keep pushing. And of course you get instruction from your teacher to move to the next level when you're ready. And you learn to look at the nature of mind itself. That's what you have to do to avoid the four formless realms. Oh, sorry, Anne, I think you had your hand up. I'm going to unmute you.
I was just wondering, are these realms, the formless realms, for instance, where Pratika Buddhas and Shravakas?
I think that that's how you can end up there. I think that is, you can, yeah, because they don't have insight meditation. They don't have emptiness. But I'm not an expert on this. But we do, I mean, Pratyeka Buddhas and Shravaka Buddhas, as we learned in chapter one on Buddha nature, like those are, they're strong connections with our Buddha nature, but they're not complete. And what they're lacking is usually said to be compassion. So that's all I know.
Thank you.
Good question though. Okay, anybody else? Okay, Lama Jinzong. Yes, you're unmuted.
Here's an opportunity to confuse us more, but my understanding, at least with the hearers and self-realizers, the Shravaka and Pratyeka, is that they have cut through the clinging to self, you know, that they cut through the belief in itself. And my understanding of the formless realms is that it's, as you've described completely, except they still have some sense of self. And that's what defines them as still being in samsara. Mm-hmm. So I don't actually know, that's a question, whether the arhats of Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddhas, having transcended this notion of self, if they are in fact still in samsara or not. I'm not sure. I don't know. Because, I mean, the formless realms are definitely samsara. And they definitely have some level of self.
Yeah. Well, I think to transcend samsara, you also have to have the compassion. You have to have non-dualistic perception, and you also have to have compassion, which apparently comes with non-dual perception. Mm. You know, it said that if you really perfect wisdom, then compassion is part of that. So yeah, I think that those were very helpful additions to the discussion. Thank you very much.
And I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's the basic message. Really, we're really not sure. This is not what we study because we're on the Mahayana path. But it is good to know. It's good to know generally because there are different paths that we can be on. So I'm going to unmute Dave.
Earlier in the OPL, Gampopa has that part where he talks about how the Buddha takes the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas. They've passed away from all other beings in samsara, but they're stuck. And then he takes them further on with compassion.
He touches their heart with a ray of light. Yeah.
Right. They were out like in this island. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh well.
No longer with the samsaric, but they're not all the way there.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, he used the analogy of like if you were sending somebody out on a voyage that you knew was so long that they would get discouraged and decide not to go, then you would give them directions to this island where they could rest. And so that's the form and formless realms. Because he did say that there's still dualistic perception there. All right. Anyway, I think we're making some inroads into understanding this better. Anybody else? All right, then we will forge ahead. We don't have a lot more, and I really want to get to the last section of Ringu Tulku because it's really helpful. Let's see. Last four points of karma. Right, so now we're going to look pages 85 to 88. We're going to take the whirlwind tour of what are these last four points, because back on page 78, we have the 6 points that summarize karma. We've done categories, we've done characteristics, and the last four are ownership, apportionment, inflation, and ineluctability. Not the same as inelectability or unelectability. So on page 85, the third point is ownership, which is the third point or category or topic within karma. The third point is ownership, which is the fact that actions determine your personal lot. With an emphasis on your actions determine your personal lot. The consequences of the action that someone else has done will be experienced by that person alone. They come to maturity in the aggregates of their doer and no one else. So karma is completely personalized. What you do does not affect somebody else's karma, and what somebody else does not affect your karma. We are supposed to stay away from bad companions who influence us to do bad things, but the karma still comes to us. Under somebody else's influence, we do the thing. That's our karma. If they're doing the thing, they're getting the karma too, but it's their own stream of karma. Is that one clear to everybody? You break it, you own it. So the fourth point at the bottom of the same page is apportionment. The fact, I don't know why he picked these words particularly, because they're not very self-explanatory, but maybe they were the best. The fourth point is apportionment, the fact that experiences due to action are strictly apportioned. This means something very simple. Happiness or suffering is infallibly experienced as the respective consequence of virtuous or harmful action. It's just that basic, you know, basic expression of how karma works. You do good things, you get good result. You do bad things, you get bad result. That's what apportionment means. So he gives a lot of, you know, examples. There's one in Torch of Certainty. You plant a barley seed, you get barley. You plant a wheat seed, you get wheat. You won't get barley from wheat and you won't get wheat from barley. Here on page 86, from the seeds of spicy plants, spicy fruits will grow. And from sweet seeds, sweet fruits will come to grow. So it's never mixed up. You know, good actions always lead to good result. Bad actions always lead to bad result. That's apportionment. The fifth point at the bottom of page 86, the fifth point is inflation, the fact that great results can be created by a small cause. This means that the longer the interval between the act and the karmic result, the greater the payment, you know, it's interest bearing. Karma is interest bearing. It has been taught that it is possible even for a single moment of evil action to cause you to experience an eon in the hells. And then it says somewhere else. There's a fair amount here. Let's see, where's that other thing? Oh, it's on the next page. I actually have it marked, page 87. It is also the case that even a small virtuous action can induce great consequence. So that little old lady that you helped across the street, that could pay off really big, like in some future lifetime. And so this is one of the, like, this came from the Buddha. Like, you can't remember, like, exactly how I've seen it phrased, but basically, and Zhongong Kongtrul says this in Torch of Certainty as well, never pass up the chance to do a virtuous act, no matter how small. Like, no helpful act is too small to be worth doing. And this explains why. Even a small virtuous act can induce great consequence. So now we're up to the final, sixth and final topic within karma, or characteristic of karma, karmic result. The sixth point is ineluctability. which means inevitability, the fact that karma never just fades away. It's like, oh, maybe nobody noticed that. There's no cosmic person. There's no God up there. There's no, you know, I mean, I'm sorry if anybody here is also Christian, because I'm just speaking from Buddhist point of view here. There's nobody, you know, watching us and deciding what's going to happen to us. It all unfolds naturally. Remember the 12 links? It all unfolds naturally once you have the cause in place. And it never just fades away. It never, you sweep it under the rug. It never just stays under the rug. Like, you can't get rid of it. Except for the case of action that has been properly remedied. Very important. And that's what Ringu Tuku just said to us, that, you know, it's not inevitable that we'll have a result only because there are things we can do to mitigate it. Where are we now? Except for the case of action that has been properly remedied, results will not be lost or become any weaker with time, even though the karma may not ripen for endless eons. In fact, we just learned the opposite, that it's paid off with interest. The longer the wait, the more you pay. Although you may have been in a state of ease for a considerable period, and we could apply this to our own lives, like, just because things have been good for a long time doesn't mean that there's not some karma lurking around the corner, something bad. So although you may have been in a state of ease for a considerable period, the result will be induced whenever you encounter the requisite circumstances, whatever they may be. So that's all that we're going to read from Ornament of Precious Liberation. We are now going to read the last section of Ringu Tulku, but does anybody have any questions or comments before we get to that? Looks like we may have a little time left over for discussion after we read Ringu Tulku, depending on how much, you know, how much I interject. So if you do have, like, any kind of thoughts are appreciated at the end, or we can always just do some meditation. So on page 48. Breaking the chain of karma. This is what it's all about, really. just like with the 12 links, it's all about how can I stop this cycle from happening again and again? Where are the points where I can intervene? Well, where are the points we can intervene to break the chain of karma? So he says, as long as we are prisoners of this process of karmic accumulation, whether the karma is negative or positive, we are chained to samsara. And actually, Trolog Rinpoche has something really helpful to say that we have to get to. It's very short. I'm in his book on karma, about why we're going to say that positive karma still chains you to samsara, but there are reasons to accumulate positive karma. It's still important to accumulate positive karma. It's just that it's not enough to free you from samsara. So anyway, creating positive, then negative, then neutral karma, we go around in circles, up and down, in the confusion of samsara, God's realm, back down to the hell realm, back up to the animal realm, back down to the hell realm, back up to the human realm. You know, it never ends. As Gampopa told us in the introduction, it ain't going to stop by itself. It's just going to keep going round and round. We have to actually take action to stop it. And that's what this is about. What can we do? Like, what action do we need to take? Well, here's the first glimmer of light. All karmas are temporary, says Ringu Tulku. The results appear and disappear. They are not part of us. They are adventitious and temporary. Adventitious means it's just like a stain. It's like something that's not part of the, it's not an integral part of the thing. It is therefore possible for us to completely break the chain and free ourselves. So these like karmic actions and karmic roles, they're not really who we are. They're not part of our Buddha nature. We're cleaning them up. We can clean them up. All karma, whether positive or negative, can be purified. Even the most negative karma can be washed off when we sincerely regret what we have done and commit ourselves to not doing it again. Where have we heard that before? Yes, Marilyn's holding up four fingers, and everybody knows what that means. The four powers, four opponent powers. So the first one I break into two, recognize it and regret it. This is the way to do it. You did something bad. You did it just now, or you did it 20 years ago. You did it in a dream, even. I feel like dreams, like, let's purify those too, because who knows where that's coming from. You recognize it. Oh, I did something bad. You regret it. Oh, I shouldn't have done it. That caused harm to somebody. That's the first opponent power, the recognition and the regret. You resolve never to do it again, number two. And then you rely on the three jewels, and you, meaning, I think, study content. You just continue your practice. You know, remember your role model here is the Buddha. Just remember that. And the Dharma is your way of following in his footsteps and doing the same thing. And the Sangha is your support. Remember those and then remediate it however you can. And the remediation, as it's usually presented within the Dharma, is not so much saying you're sorry and making amends, although I think that's really important if you can. It's about Dorje Senpa. It's about the practices that we can do to purify negative karma. So, Even the most negative karma can be washed off when we sincerely regret what we have done and commit ourselves to not doing it again. And the obstacle to that is just to really recognize it, right? It's just to realize I did it, just to take that moment and go, oh, wait, no, I shouldn't have done that. I hurt somebody, or I just messed up my karma. So it's about mindfulness, like everything else. And then we then replace negative karma with positive karma. So that's replace the 10 negative actions with the 10 positive actions. And Gampopa gave us the roadmap for that. But we can go even further. And the best thing we can do is to break the chain of karma once and for all. This is possible if we completely eliminate our ignorance, which is the illusion of ego. Conquering our ignorance, our confusion, liberates us from the grip of ego. As soon as there is no longer anyone, in quotes, to experience the results of karma, its chain is broken. As soon as you realize that yourself is empty, that there's, you're just the five skandhas, you know, there's no there there, that breaks the chain. That's overcoming ignorance, is to realize that. As soon as there is no longer anyone to experience the results of karma, its chain is broken. 12 links, that's the chain. Without accumulation of karma, there are no more karmic results. And that's, I've told this story before too, but I'm going to say it again. My very first teaching on the five skandhas with Lama Norla Rinpoche in 1980, I got there early with my friend Carolyn, and I had my notebook, and he found it amusing that we took notes on things. And we got there early, and there was nobody else there yet, and we were sitting, and he was sitting on his seat, and he said, take out your notebook. I want you to write this down in big letters, no cause, no result. So that's what Ringu Tulku is saying here, no cause, no result. We don't do it, we don't reap the result. So we're going to skip the story. It's a very nice story about Ajatashatru, and you can read that on your own. I'm sure that everyone already has, how he freed himself through realizing the emptiness of the self that was going to experience the result of some terrible karma he had accumulated. So we're going to go a little bit down, page 49. The main aim of Dharma is to break the karmic chain. That's the point of all the teachings, to break this attachment, this grasping, this identification, which is the very root of samsara. Reducing the identification with a self, the attachment to this idea of ego, allows us to let go, to relax. We can at last put down a useless burden we have been carrying for too long. This is very important to understand, even as far as our daily life is concerned, and particularly in the West, where the psychological approach tends to explain every problem in relation to childhood experiences. According to the Buddhist approach, it's the memory, the attachment to memories, that is the real source of problems. In fact, you're no longer that child who was mistreated, unloved, misunderstood. We learned how that works, if we remember, in Lama Jinzong's first teaching on when Ringu Tulku explained rebirth, how rebirth works. You know, what is it that goes forward from our childhood or from this lifetime? We are no longer that child that whose past, you're no longer that child who was mistreated, unloved, misunderstood. That suffering only affects you now because you think you still are that person. If you didn't grasp at those memories, if you didn't identify with the child that you once were, those past experiences would no longer matter and couldn't affect you. They would simply be memories of events that happened to someone else, that happened to that 7-year-old girl or boy. As soon as we understand that the past is past, and that's our first instruction, right? In basic Shinai meditation, our very first instruction, do not follow thoughts of the past. As soon as we understand that the past is past, that it's simply a memory, we instantly relieve ourselves of problems that we have been carrying around with us for too long. So easier said than done, right? I mean, I know we all have stuff, and it's not easy to put that burden down, but it's a process, and we can remind ourselves again and again as these things resurface, I'm not that person anymore. It's the past, it's gone. So therefore, says Ringu Tulku, let's try to understand and deeply realize emptiness. Understanding and experiencing absolute truth, emptiness, is the ultimate weapon that can cut off the chain of karma. Same thing we learned in the 12 links. The real place to intervene is ignorance. Because if you don't have ignorance, if you don't have basic dualistic perception that thinks that this is all real, that it's me and all this stuff and all these other people, if you don't have that, then nothing happens. There's no problem. Okay, so however, it is also very important to know that at the same time, we must under no circumstances ignore karma or minimize its effects. As long as we experience an ego, we are in confusion and ignorance and therefore under the power of the effects of karma. So as long as we are in relative reality, we have to abide by the rules of relative reality. The Buddha taught the first turning of the wheel, which is all of these rules and guidelines, the 12 links and the 10 unvirtuous actions and all of this stuff. And then he taught the second turning of the wheel, emptiness, like none of it really exists. But it doesn't negate the first turning of the wheel. We still have to operate within relative reality. So karma is still important and we must avoid negative actions. Even if we understand emptiness, we think we really understand everything is empty, we still have to engage in positive actions and not engage in negative actions. So consequently, says Ringu Tulku as he wraps this up, be as careful as possible to accumulate good karma and avoid negative karma while continuing to develop our understanding of ultimate reality. These instructions are the pith instructions of the Kadampa Lamas, which is the monastic stream that Gampopa merged with the direct realization stream of Mahamudra. So yes, you can through Mahamudra, you can directly realize the nature of things, which is empty, but it's only one of the two streams. We still have relative reality to deal with. So never forget that. That is something people actually do forget. You see that all the time in comments on Facebook and so forth. So one more thing, and then we probably have a few minutes, is I just wanted to share this thing from Trailog Rinpoche. It's not like completely capsulized in a completely and absolutely clear way, but it's really helpful. He says, and this is responding to this idea that even positive karma traps us in samsara. We're not out of samsara. So we have to purify positive karma too. I mean, Ringu Tulku said that. But here's what Trailog Rinpoche has to say, which is just another nuance. It's not negating Ringu Tulku, but it's another nuance to it. He said, in Buddhism, it is said that by creating good karma, we can actually stop creating karma altogether. In short, positive karma is also a road to liberation. This notion is very poorly understood at present. People fail to appreciate the different qualities of bad and good karma. Like it's not all one thing. It's not just karma and we need to avoid it all. Thinking that if we habituate ourselves to good karma in preference to bad, it nevertheless still amounts to a habituation. We are still going to get stuck doing good if we're doing good karma, and how are we going to free ourselves from that? He says the fundamental reason why this can be done is because good karma done properly, created properly, is not habit-forming. It's not digging you deeper into samsara. It is not habit-forming because it is spontaneous, arising from a mentality where ego is not central. So positive actions are actually working against ego clinging. Others first is actually like thinking of the other person's welfare. I'm not going to kill this person. I'm not going to steal from this person. I'm not going to lie to this person. But it's going to harm them in some way. That is counteracting. That's in opposition to ego clinging, which always wants. It's always looking for your own benefit. So good karma, even though it's still technically within samsara, he's saying here, it helps to free us from ego clinging. Just doing positive actions. He says, habit-forming activities issue from ego obsession. So when we rest the ego a little and bypass the me thinking, we become more outwardly directed and more outwardly engaged. A richness flows into this type of environment on many levels, and all this relates back to Buddhism's basic core, which is the problem of ego clinging. So I'm going to stop there. He goes on a bit, but it kind of rambles a little bit. It was an oral teaching. But the basic point is don't get worried when it says even positive karma doesn't free you from samsara and we have to purify it all. There's still a really important distinction between negative karma and positive karma. For one thing, better to be in the higher realms. Like if you're engaging in negative karma, you will not get a precious human existence, which is your ticket to freedom. So, and that's what Ringu Tulku said. Remember karma, keep engaging in positive actions, even as you work to counteract basic ignorance and realize ultimate bodhicitta. So that's what I got for today. And we still have a few minutes. Does anybody have anything that they would like to say? Yes, Valerie, I'm going to unmute you.
There's such a thing as group karma.
There is. There's collective karma. It's basically how we all have similar perceptions. Like we can all see each other and we experience the world in, you know, at least basically similar ways. I think there was a little section on collective karma in Ringu Tulku and I skipped over it, but you can look back through that chapter and find it. But, you know, one of the things I learned from Trailog Rinpoche's book on karma, you know, what karma is, what it isn't, and why it matters, I think is the name of it. is that, because we had this problem a little bit at our Dharma Center in Richmond. There was this guy who had sort of a Hindu background, and he kept making statements about karma that weren't true. Like, and I would say that's not what the Buddha taught. And he said, yes, it is. Yes, it is. Well, it was coming from his Hindu background, where there's something, and I don't remember this in detail, but in the very first chapter of the Trial of Rinpoche book, he talks about the differences between the Hindu concept of karma and the Buddhist. And there's some way in Hindu karma where the collective karma is sort of a bigger deal, and you can be affected by other people's negative actions and vice versa. But our collective karma doesn't work like that. You know, our actions are very individual. Like, it's our actions that get the karmic result to us, and it can't influence somebody else's karmic result and so forth. But so the way that we understand collective karma in Buddhism on a very simplistic level, and I don't understand it beyond that, is there's a collective karma that makes us all live in the same basic environment. We all have, you know, the same government and same oceans and all that, same maps. All right. I can't answer it any better than that. Is there any further follow-up? Anything more specific, Valerie?
Well, a friend of mine was telling me about this.
Can you just get a little closer to your computer?
A friend of mine had a very old Jewish friend, and she was telling her a story about how when they got out of the camps, the three women all got married to somebody quickly, and they shared this blue dress. She starts crying, and I'm thinking, I bet she was there, you know? Like, she seems so attached to this story and these people, and that's why I'm wondering.
Yeah. Well, I would say, you know, even, I do think that we have certain karmic connections that are forged in the past. I mean, how do you end up in the same family with certain people? I mean, I think you have, your karma is more tied in with like certain other people than with, you know, other people. That's where the near and far people come from in some of the Buddhist teachings. But again, karma is just so complex that we don't want to spend too much of our energy trying to figure it out. And I certainly don't know what the answer would be about the blue dress. But thanks for sharing that. Anybody else have anything? Nothing from Mark Hoyer? Oh, we got Deidre. You're off the hook, Mark.
Oh, wait a second. Go ahead.
Okay, Mark, go ahead, and then Deidre.
No, I just thought that when you were describing samsara as, I think you were saying more or less equal to subject-object duality, fixation. Mm-hmm. I think maybe that's the way to go, to try to understand it rather than trying to understand all the details of, you know, different levels of karma and things.
Yeah, that keep your eye on subject-object duality.
Yeah,
that's the basic definition. Ignorance is it. You know, we knock ignorance out, then there's no samsara. Okay, thank you very much, Mark. And Deidre, go ahead.
For me, the study of karma was back when we were doing the Dharma path, and I think it was the words of my perfect teacher. And I just happened to remember a lot on that chapter of karma. And I thought, it was very beneficial to understanding what more is happening in my life and in the world. I didn't worry about it. I think I could draw correlations between certain karmas and could see more reasons of how things are the way they are. Mm-hmm. So, I don't think I took it like to heart as far as worrying about everything I did or what everybody else did.
Yeah.
But I think it is beneficial to know, you know, like one of them is like, I think they said, and I happened to be having a lot of trouble in my marriage at the time, that is from sowing discord among the Sangha in a previous life. So for me, I immediately shifted the responsibility onto myself and away from the person who I was complaining about.
Yeah.
That's I mean, it really just depends, I think, on how you can use it to better your life, you know, to make you a kind of a more solid Dharma person, which to me is also recognizing that everything has to do with ourselves, you know, with self-responsibility more than blaming.
Yeah.
So for me, karma was that way. Also recognizing that if you have lied, you cannot hear the truth. So we wonder why intelligent people cannot see through someone's lies.
Right.
For me, it's another kind of thing like, well, that's, you know, that's because, you know, when we lie, we just, and that's almost immediate too, because you can tell a con artist is the easiest person to con, you know, it's like instant karma. But I think having a little bit of knowledge, I'm not saying a little bit of knowledge because that could be dangerous, but understanding how to apply the knowledge for understanding more the human condition, the animal condition, you know, is, for me, it was very beneficial.
Yeah, I agree. I think Gampopa wouldn't have given us this level of information if he didn't think there was a practical application to it, that it could help us free ourselves from samsara. So it's good. You know, the cautionary note is just not to get too deep into trying to figure it out, that you fritter away your Dharma energy on theoretical things rather than actually applying yourself to practice. But yeah, thanks for bringing that out. I appreciate that. Okay, Lama Jinzong, you are unmuted.
So just to be brief, I think also you use the word responsibility, Deirdre, and I think that's a big one, that the key point is always, and when people say, well, you know, talk about Buddhism really quick, and I'm sort of like, well, you know, we don't, the fact that there's no proselytizing, because it's up to everybody's karma. The point is, it really comes down to each and every one of us is responsible for ourselves. You know, like my mom used to say when she saw Lama Nyingma Rinpoche, she goes, well, I don't really know Buddhism, but I certainly believe that, you know, we make our own happiness, we create our own suffering. And so ultimately, it really is the responsibility, taking the responsibility. And there was something else I wanted to say, which was gone. So there went.
Maybe it will come to you during the prayers.
What if?
Yeah.
Yeah, what was it? I don't remember. Okay, carry on. Well, and if I remember.
You got a minute or two. We'll open up the mics again at the end.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, anybody else before we go? It's a little after 3:30, so we probably should wrap up. But all right, so next week we'll be on to the third antidote to the third, the only antidote to the third obstacle to awakening, which is being too invested in personal peace. Lama Jinzong will lead us through the chapter on love and compassion, which I think we've agreed that probably most of these chapters are going to take us 2 weeks. So we'll get part one next week. I'm looking forward to that. A little bit of a, you know, a reprieve from all of this suffering, 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 suffering. All right. So let's do our prayers then. Again, let's let our minds settle just for a brief moment in readiness to dedicate the merit with sort of full attention. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangho, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha, this dedication please fulfill. Okay, I'm unmuting everybody. You're all unmuted. I appreciate everybody being here, whether you had something to say or not. And Lama Jinzong.
I didn't remember. it wasn't necessary, clearly. Okay. But just to, as we were saying, what we were going to try to do then, so for people who are curious about what the pages are in this text for the next thing, because they're different than the single chapter in Gampopa, which is on love and kindness and compassion. So the pages to read in Path of to Buddhahood are pages 50 through 54. And I'll probably be sticking, you know, pretty much in this text, but I would say read pages for the next 2 weeks, 50 to 64. That would be the, I don't know what the pages are in Gampopa. The white book is pages 89 through 97, but more likely than not, I'll really be sticking to Path to Buddhahood. Right. So that's the pages for people who want to read ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much. So that's okay. Our reading, and I will also send out an email about that. Anybody have any parting thoughts? John?
I wanted to ask a question. In the beginning, you showed me your headphone with the mic.
Yeah.
But you didn't say that was the one you were wearing last.
Yes, it is. It's the only one I ever wear. This is the one.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah, I don't have another one.
That's right. That's what I wanted to know.
Okie dokie. Good. Yes, John's always on the case trying to improve our recording quality and figure out how best to serve our needs as a community. And I appreciate it. Okay. See you next week, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.